I feel like identity management is so crucial, but it's also the least sexy of the security aspects. So much of us want to deal with, you know, incident response and malware and analysis, but like identity is really the core of what we do.
Greetings and salutations, one and all. Welcome to today's episode of Risk in Reels. I am, as always, your humble host, Jeffrey Wheatman. And I'm super excited to have my guest, Rick Patterson, on today. Rick is the CISO of Clear. Rick and I kind of ran into each other at conferences over the years. And fairly recently, we struck up a little bit of a friendship on LinkedIn. And we started talking about some cool stuff that we're going to talk about today. And Rick has an interesting background, which he'll share with you momentarily. But say hello to our listeners, Mr. Rick Patterson.
Thanks for having me on, Jeff. Jeffrey, I'm going to do that.
Oh, that's okay. You know what? As I tell people, I'm in my mid-50s. I have way more stuff to care about, whether you call me Jeff or Jeffrey. And you know the old adage, right? As long as you don't call me late for supper, I am good. So Rick, why don't we, before we jump in, maybe share with our listeners a little bit about your background, because I think you have some really, really cool stuff that kind of led you to your current role.
Sure. So I've been doing cybersecurity and security for almost 30 years. Really started back in the government. I spent 13 years in Army CID in the Secret Service. When I was in the Army, in Army CID, we didn't have a lot of forensic examiners, so I was actually taking Polaroids of computer screens as evidence for computer crime cases back in the old days. And that kind of led me to the Secret Service, where I got involved with it was called the XSAP program, Electronic Crime Special Agent Program. We were forensic examiners. We were agents, but we were trained in computer forensics and incident response. So I finished my career with the Secret Service in the XSAP program, helped set up the Electronic Crimes Task Force in Chicago, and then finished my government career and kind of transitioned into the private sector. My first job out of the government was with Sidley Austin. It's like a global law firm. I was kind of the first security, I had a team of one. We had somebody running bone scans back in the old days and really built that program there from scratch. And I built it into more of a converged program, so physical and cyber. And that kind of became my thing, is like running converged programs. And from there, I went to PetSmart, kind of my first exposure in retail, and spent a couple of years there in Arizona. Had to get away from the weather in Chicago. And then from there, transitioned to Bridgewater, hedge fund on the East Coast. And I spent 7 years at Bridgewater kind of building different parts of the security program. So I started with architecture, built their first operational risk program, and then took over operations for my last couple of years there. And then that led me to my current role at Clear. I've been the CISO there for a little over 3 years and kind of came in to kind of scale the program, take the company public from a security perspective, build that out as well.
Right. Awesome. So I know our listeners can't see you, but I got to tell you, you look much too young to have that kind of a career. So good for you. You must be living a good life, man. First of all, let me say thank you for your service. I always appreciate people that go into public service. One thing you said that was super interesting that I just want to kind of share. So you talked about using screen snapshots for forensics. So earlier in my career, I worked at Martha Stewart, and I was in charge of security during the investigation when she was up against charges. And at the time, right, the law firms now, they all have cyber people, but they didn't back then. And the FBI asked me for all of her files, right? So I downloaded her files on a CD-ROM, dating myself. And then I basically ran MD checksums on all of the files and burned that to another CD. And I put them in two separate envelopes and I mailed them. And the law firm said, well, why'd you do that? And I said, well, those are MD5 checksum to make sure no one changed the files. And you know what the law firm said? Why would anyone want to do that? Which even at the time, I was like, really? Because I could think of a lot of reasons. But it's just, it's amazing how far it's come to, you know, from screenshots and burning CD-ROMs to the current capability around forensics.
It is crazy how far the field has advanced. Like, I think this was like 98, 99. I remember at some point I went to see the one computer forensic examiner we had in the Army. And that was kind of what I really got interested in. He had just had a room full of tech and I love tech. So I was like, oh, this sounds like the perfect job for me. I just get to play with computer equipment and do forensics. But yeah, I mean, the fact that I could take a Polaroid of a computer screen that was admissible, it just showed you the lack of knowledge that the attorneys and the judges even had back then.
Yeah. And to be fair, I still think some of the attorneys and judges, I think, still don't necessarily understand the technology. We hear some of the lawsuits that are out there. So let's get started. As everyone knows, we always start off with a movie question. So name a movie where the plot is basically built around a case of mistaken identity.
Well, you use Life of Brian last in your last podcast that I heard. So I won't use Life of Brian. That's probably one of the more classic, and I'm a fan of Monty Python. So I'll say North by Northwest, and then I'm going to add a little bit to it. When I was in undergrad, I took a film music class, and my professor was a big fan of Hitchcock. And I think it was Bernstein was the person who did a lot of the music for Hitchcock movies. So we watched that in class, a classic mistaken identity based on just someone raising their hand when they call out a name. And then everyone assumed he was the person that they were looking for. But, you know, I think identity in movies is interesting. And I know usually these are quick questions. I'll just add a little bit. I love sci-fi, so that's kind of my thing. And Ready Player One is a kind of a guilty pleasure of mine. Growing up as a kid of the 80s, and there's so much culture there. But from an identity perspective, the movie's supposed to be in 2045. And I don't know if you've seen the movie or read the book.
I've seen the movie and I've read the book and I've listened to Will Wheaton doing the audiobook, which I think of the three is my favorite. He's amazing.
Okay. So we're the same kind of interest. So yeah. I feel a little guilty saying, or a little embarrassed saying this is one of my favorite books, but it was a great vacation read. But anyways, the fact that you have all this biometrics, they scan their face when they put on the goggles, but Nolan Sorrento has a password, a simple password taped to his rig. And that's how they broke in and impersonated him in one of the key scenes. I think is like pretty sad of the state of password management in 2045 and identity.
So mine is, I'm going a slightly different way. There's a movie called The History of Violence that stars Viggo Mortensen. And rather than a case of mistaken identity, it's actually a case of him trying to change his identity. He was an enforcer and a hitman for some Eastern European mob, but it's he's trying to change his identity and the past comes back to get him. And then when he settles back in, let's just say he does some serious damage. And I'm actually a big fan of him as, you know, from the Lord of the Rings. So you talked about identity, and I think that's a great topic for us to talk about. So much of our security posture is based on proving you are who you say you are. What is it that you see as maybe some of the biggest challenges around identity and identity management, you know, in this digital world that we live in?
I feel like identity management is so crucial, but it's also the least sexy of the security aspects. So much of us want to deal with, you know, incident response and malware and analysis, but like identity is really the core of what we do. As far as like the challenges, so much of identity is based on possession of something or knowledge of a secret. The ability to transfer that secret really undermines our ability to verify, like with high efficacy, someone's identity. And I think that's where biometrics is really one of the most interesting technologies in this space. And if you follow like Dorothy Denning, she's like, they call her the godmother of liveness. She coined the idea that biometrics are not secrets and the key is liveness. And the ability that you can present a biometric and then verify that the person presenting it is actually the person presenting it is the essence and the key of biometrics and why biometrics can be so strong. You know, you think about password management and how easy it is to lose those secrets. And then once they're lost, you have to reissue them. Whereas in biometrics, those aren't secrets. And if you can verify liveness, you can't lose your biometrics. Like your face is not something that is a secret for one. And obviously you can't reissue your face. So the strength of biometrics is around the technology of liveness. And it really is the key to verifying identity. And I think about when I was in the Secret Service doing forensics, one of the challenges we had was putting the bad guy behind the computer. Like we could look at a computer and analyze it and pull evidence off it, but actually showing that that person was in possession of the computer and was logging in. And you really had to do it, piece it together with like, well, there was a password. They're the only ones who knew the password. You looked at the activity on the computer. They're the only ones that went to their bank account. They're the only ones that did this, but you still have that struggle of putting a person behind a computer or a person behind a secret, like a password.
You use the term liveness. So I've never actually heard that term used before. What does that mean exactly?
Well, I'll give you an example. So if you are, there's a lot of movie spoofing of liveness, but you think about if you're going up to a scanner, it's doing like use your phone to do verification of your photo, like with your iPhone. So your iPhone takes a video image of you, your face, and does some kind of liveness. And so what it does is making sure that the person presenting the face is there's some dynamic capability quality to it. So they can shine different lights at your eyes to see if your irises react. They can shine light to see that there's textures. You're not putting a photograph in front of the camera. It's basically trying to defeat the mechanisms that are used to bypass biometrics.
Right. So like when we see in the movies, when somebody plunges the hand of a deceased person into a vat of some plastic. Yeah. Okay.
Gotcha. A liveness test would be like, is there a pulse? Is the fingerprint warm? Fingerprints are probably a little bit harder to do liveness than like face. Because face, you have so many things that can react.
Right.
Like, especially with like the pupils and the iris.
So let me ask you a sort of a devil's advocate question. We've been hearing about biometrics and talking about biometrics for 2 decades. It still isn't really the norm in a lot of cases. Why do you think that is?
Well, one, I think it does require someone to have a fair amount of technical skills to use biometrics. Like you think about phone authentication, it does eliminate a large part of our population who aren't technically capable. And this is not, the interfaces are not the most easy to use in a lot of cases. I think the iPhone has made it a lot easier and has made it more commonplace for us. But there's still, if you think about how do you integrate liveness with a banking website, or how do you integrate liveness with different, you know, like Cash App or different payment systems, that's where I think the technology still is struggling. Interfacing some kind of liveness identity verification technology with the more traditional applications, websites that actually are requiring this kind of authentication. And it's so much easier and cheaper. I think the other thing is cost. It's still a lot cheaper just to use a password or use simple two-factor with a phone, SMS texting messages for two-factor like that. I think the challenge is complexity in the technology, interfacing the technologies, and then the cost.
And do you think there's a privacy element? Like if you remember, I'm going to say maybe 18, 24 months ago, there was a push in the U.S. federal government to use ID.me as the authentication mechanism for a lot of things. And there was a big pushback going, I'm not sure I really want an entity that I don't trust to have this information. Do you think privacy is part of the challenge too?
Privacy, I mean, yes, definitely privacy is a part of the challenge. I think where ID.me got into some of the criticism was they were the only way you could get to something. And I think one of the things, like for Clear and other technologies, is it's a way, it's not the only way. It's a more secure way. So, you know, you think about how a vendor can assess the risk of an account verification. If you know that they're using a higher fidelity system that's involving biometrics, like the fraud is less, you know, the fraud is less. So there's a higher confidence that the transaction that's taking place has a lower level of fraud versus, you know, traditional methods with passwords or even MFA. So I think like privacy is important and it's critical to the integrity of the vendor that's providing the identity verification.
I actually was, I think, caught in that point where it was the only option. My finance manager, the guy that basically makes sure I don't throw all my money in the garbage, he said, I want to see what your social security looks like. And at the time, ID.me was the only way to actually get access to that system. There's probably somewhere out there impersonating me and stealing my social security.
Well, it kind of goes back to what I said. It's like people struggle with the technology. Even people who are technically competent, like these interfaces aren't fully, you know, we haven't had enough time to bake these out and ensure like the ease of use. And it's still a struggle for people to figure out.
And I think some of it too is the fact that we're always sort of trying to at least keep up with, if not get ahead of, the bad actors. And they've proven themselves to be far more nimble than we are. So got any cool stories that you could share? Obviously some of the stuff you probably can't really talk about, but any cool stories from your history around like maybe a really cool attack that you saw? And you can anonymize as much as you need to.
This is actually the coolest story that for my time in the Secret Service. I'll anonymize as best I can, and it has an identity component. So we got a tip from a company in California. This is when I was in Chicago, that someone called and asked to order ink that was in the color of money. So that's usually that's a clue. Something's probably going on there. You know, we got the lead, the person who ordered the money, and we set up surveillance. And I was in what we called this was before I got into forensics. I was still doing technical. My investigative mission was more, I stayed in the technical side. So I did like the investigative support stuff. So trackers, phone taps, DNRs, surveillance cameras, all that kind of stuff. So I was putting the tracker on this guy's car. And I'd crawl out like in the middle of the night once a week and put a tracker. And this is, technology was still limited back then. So I literally had to go out and crawl into the car and download all of his movements physically, get there. It wasn't like we could connect to a cellular network and download that way. So it was still pretty early days. And we figured out this guy was running a fraudulent identity ring and providing identities to people in the Chicago area who shouldn't have identities. And then we ended up arresting the guy. He turns evidence against a bigger ring that was going on. Turns out he kept committing crimes and doing what he was a professional at doing. So then we arrested him again, and then we put him on house arrest. So now he had an ankle bracelet. I'm not going to talk about any of the names. So I think that'll keep me out of, and this has all been adjudicated long. He's actually passed away, the main suspect. So he put a he had a tracker on his ankle and was under house arrest. And then he concocted this scheme with his brother, who was a doctor, to lure a homeless person to his house. They murdered him. They put the ankle bracelet on the homeless person, and then his brother faked the death certificate as if it was his brother. And so they took him to the morgue. He was in the morgue. And so from our understanding, the person that was on house arrest, our main suspect, was like a very large individual. And that point is relevant to the story. So the two agents, one of them was a good buddy of mine. He went to the morgue to identify the body, and the homeless person they killed was this very skinny, thin man. And so with the sheet over it, they just walked right by the body, and the ME was like, no, that's the guy right there. And like, that ain't the guy. So it turns out he had taken off and was heading towards what we thought he was going to, the border, the Canadian border, to flee. And we used some technology to track him down. And I was actually on the phone with him. I kept him on the phone while our teams like surrounded him and arrested him. But that was probably the most interesting case that I'd worked in the Secret Service. The whole thing unwound because that a physical verification of the identity of a suspect.
That's awesome. So I have a question. Did the guy literally call the ink company and go, hey, you have any ink the color of money? Yes. Or did he give them like, I just feel like some of these people, if they put half the effort into being business people, they'd probably be better off not going into the car, because clearly not that bright, right? And if the doctor doesn't think, oh, they're going to, you weigh 400 pounds, this dude weighs like 7 pounds, we're good.
Yeah, I was always amazed. And I, just in the inverse, how much some criminals would put into their criminal endeavors. If they would have just had a legit job, they could have made as much money and not had the risk of going to jail. Some of the fraudsters, especially the check fraud, I was amazed at like the operations some of these guys would run to commit check fraud schemes. And their income was, you know, moderate at best. And then we'd catch them eventually and go to jail.
I think one of the best examples is Frank Abagnale Jr. Now, whether in fact he did the things he said he did is an entirely different question. But his whole thing, he wasn't really looking to make money. He was just looking to live. Even if 10% of what that guy said he did, right, it was amazing. That's a great story. That may be my favorite story I've heard in doing the podcast
It's a crazy story. Like I just. And there's a lot more even to that story than what I told. It was like, it is a really, there's some connection with organized crime. It was like a very interesting story.
Have you ever thought about writing it up as a book?
I've thought about so many little stories through my career, like could make some interesting, even Army CID, I worked some interesting cases there too as well.
Yeah. Cause like I would tell, like there were a couple of things that got me into security. And one of them was actually the book Cuckoo's Egg by Cliff Stahl.
Yeah.
And that whole book, you know, talk about dating, right? That was back when they were physically plugging plugs in and he was like sleeping in the phone center. That whole thing was just incredible. And again, he called like White Sands Missile Base and he said, you guys are under attack, and they hung up on him.
Yeah.
So let's kind of look to the future. What do you see as the future of identity, right? Because we see all these different, I always said identity and access management is one of the most complicated sets of problems and solutions we have. There are so many facets of it. There are elements and process and things. Like, what do you see as the future of identity? Where are we going here?
Well, I mean, clearly we're investing in the biometric side of this and identity verification, but beyond beyond biometrics as the technology that we're using to verify identities, it's really around source corroboration. Like, how do you ensure the original identity is valid? And I think when you think about in the US, motor vehicle associations, there is a large number of them, like I think in excess of 30, actually have a system that you can corroborate identities with. And I think that's a key point, is with the real IDs coming out and with source corroboration, like, now we can actually verify the ID is valid, then verify the persons to that ID through biometrics, through the image. And then you look at some of the liveness technologies. If you look online, you can look at, like, just type in liveness vendors. You'll see, you know, there's 20, 30 vendors out there. So I think there's starting to be more technology being developed around that space. So I think the combination of source corroboration, increasing the document veracity or the authenticity of documents. And then second is like the biometric linking the person to the document. Like, passports are the best document because it's, you know, controlled and it's one agency that's issuing passports. Whereas driver's license are kind of it's becoming less the Wild West, but you'd be amazed at how bad some driver's license are for some states. Like, the photograph quality is terrible. Like, it's hard to even tell if it's a real ID, and it's a real ID, and you're like, this looks like a fake ID. And
right. And the pictures too, they don't require you to update them. Yeah. So like, I've seen people with driver's license, I go, you haven't looked like this in quite some time, my friend.
I know. Like, I think when I was in Arizona, my license was valid for like 20 years and I didn't have to, it was like crazy how long you'd have your license would be valid. So I think like people go through a lot of changes and then like the IDs don't match. So that the getting better photographs, where that's why passports are the best, because usually the passport quality, the photo quality is the best.
So let's come back to something you said before, which is around the sort of technical hurdles, right? How do we help people who maybe don't have computers, don't have phones, right? There are still lots of people in the United States and throughout the world that don't have access to these things. How do we fix that? Or how do we at least make it easier for those folks?
I mean, I think one is a physical presence. So having a brick and mortar presence where you can help people through this is like key. And I think that's where other vendors struggle, is without having that physical presence, you can't help people work through it. Especially when you deal with like communities, whether they're older and they don't have a lot of exposure to technology, or they're just not technically capable. Some people just, it's not their thing. And so having that kind of physical presence, I think, is important. I think research, I think, you know, colleges, universities, they're doing usability research. I remember when I was in my graduate work at DePaul, there was a lot on studying computer usability and how to make it more user-friendly and easier for people to use, especially with like, you think about handicapped people. So people who have challenges in different areas, like, how do you make technology available to them where they have literally a physical handicap that inhibits them from using certain pieces of technology? So I think like it's a combination of, we need more research and study in this space. And then I think definitely physical presence is key to help people work through technologies. Like, I think some of the vendors you mentioned, like, they don't have the physical presence. You have to go online, try and work through some kind of online help, or you have to call them to a help desk that may be outsourced and they may have their own challenges.
And I think the pandemic too caused some challenges there, because I think a lot of people gave up the brick and mortar and people got used to not going and being able to do everything online. And, you know, like, I haven't been to the supermarket since COVID because we use a delivery service, and I'm actually a much happier person because going to the supermarket's not that fun. So having a background in the public sector, do you see the government having a role in doing some of that research and at least helping drive some standards to kind of move this forward?
You know, it's funny because there's a couple like corollaries. Like, when I go going back to my early days of the Secret Service, like the Social Security number as an identifier and as a secret, like that was a failed. That was not the original intent of the Social Security number, was to be a secret that people possessed. And that's why it got so quickly abused. I remember when the vaccine cards were first coming out during COVID. And in order to do some things, you had to show that you were vaccinated. And I remember I was on a podcast or something and I was talking about it and I was connecting it to counterfeit currency. I was saying, like, unless the government standardizes vaccine cards and how to do it, it's not going to work. I remember when I was a bouncer back in college and I had this giant book that you would go through and look for each state's ID to see what are the characteristics of each state ID. And they're all different. Going back to what I said earlier, like half these IDs are so bad. You're like, this looks fake, but it's actually a real ID. So I think the government has to standardize. And I think you're seeing that. We're seeing them move to, you know, the real ID is a good example of the government moving to a more standardized way for identities. It's just slow. Everything with the government takes a long time. I mean, you're moving, you know, it's not like we're not a small country. We're a big country. We're 50 states. We have a lot of, you know, independence. Each state wants to do their own thing. So it's hard to get everybody behind one standard. With the advancements in computer technology, I don't want to use the two-letter acronym that everybody else is the most AI. Everybody's using AI. But so, like, obviously, we're going to see a lot of advancements in computer technology, and how will that help us in this space? Like, obviously, it'll be huge. But also, you know, you mentioned the arms race. Like, I feel like attackers can use the advances in computer technology much faster. For, you know, you talk about the deep fakes and the fake IDs. That's why source corroboration is so important. Like, even if you can create a really good fake, if you can corroborate with a source like a DMV that this is not a valid ID, that's the key to having a high confidence that the ID is valid and the person presenting the ID is the person in that ID. That's like the key. And then going back to your original question, which is how do we make this available for all? I think it's a combination of the government and private sector working together to make technology more easily accessible by everybody.
Yeah. And I think we've definitely seen some, I think, progress around public-private partnerships. Back in season one, I had Bailey Bickley from the NSA on, and we talked a lot about public-private partnerships. And one of the things she said was, look, as the government, we need to stop telling people. We need to start working with them and having a dialogue, because we've been telling them for a long time. It hasn't worked all that well. Partnerships that we're seeing now, you know, with some of the great work like that CISA has been doing around vulnerability management and kind of getting that stuff out there. I mean, obviously not identity related, but I think that stuff is super powerful. So, all right. So we are running up against our allotted time, and I know you are super busy. Everybody's super busy these days. So let me do a little bit of a recap, and then I'll hand it back to you for any final thoughts. So, first thing, definitely go check out Dorothy Deming's work. She is amazing and has done incredible things. Biometrics are definitely, we think, the future, but there needs to be some more technical improvement. It needs to be easier to use. It needs to be simplified. And I love the concept of liveness. It is unusual after being in the field for so long that I'm hit with a term that I don't know. So I'm glad I learned something from you today, which is always awesome. My dad always said, a day you don't learn anything is a wasted day. And then we talked a little bit about how do we get this exposure to people that maybe don't have the tech or don't have the technical expertise. And you talked about having physical presence. So for those of you out there that are doing this work, you got to give people an opportunity to come in and face to face so they can figure this stuff out. It sounds like there's some really, really good research going on around usability. And then you mentioned something about SSNs being an identifier. So my old friend Jay Heiser said years ago that the biggest mistake ever made was using national identification numbers as identity. And then the source corroboration, and I think that's a great concept. Where is the authentic source of the data, and can you actually track it back there? So great, great stuff. So thanks, Rick, again, and definitely check Rick out on LinkedIn. He posts some really cool stuff there. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast so that you don't miss any of our future guests. So with that, stay safe, stay healthy, stay secure. Wheatman out.
Thank you for listening to Risk and Reels, a cybersecurity podcast. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to riveting 30-minute conversations about movies and cybersecurity. Jeffrey will be on the road this year at some of the industry's biggest events, but you can always find him on LinkedIn and Twitter at Jeffrey Wheatman. This podcast is powered by Black Kite, the only security rating service to deliver the highest quality intelligence to help organizations make better risk decisions.